Hello, welcome to Newspeak. I'm here, as usual, I'm pleased to say, with our senior fellow, Rafe Hadelman-Kew, royal commentator and historian, and Amy Gallagher, the SDP's candidate for London Mayor, and also the woman behind the Stand Up to Woke campaign, which is also the name of your campaign for London, isn't it? That's right. Before we talk about the week's events, just a couple of notices about our locals. We have two different locals events this week on the same day. It's on Wednesday, that's the 17th of April, Wednesday the 17th, this coming Wednesday, in the evening. One of them is in Carlisle and one is in Beaconsfield. So very, very far from each other, but please do come along if you're in either of those places. Should be great, you know, it's free. It's a chance to meet like-minded people, and they're proving very popular. Best way to do that is to get in touch with us, to write to locals@newcultureforum.org.uk, and we can send you the whys and the wherefores, okay? So that is this coming Wednesday, or 17th of April. Starting this week with something which I think profoundly important, Rafe, but actually got very little coverage, and that is a survey done by the Henry Jackson Society about Muslim attitudes to, amongst other things, the Israeli-Gaza conflict, wasn't it?
That's right. So this is a very important poll, because there have been several of these done over the past 15 years, but it's been a little while since we had the last one, and it's an important gauge and measure into how poorly we are doing in terms of integrating vast numbers of Muslims into this country. Now, it has to be said, you know, on the positive side, vast swathes of the Muslim population are well integrated, but it's not an overwhelming majority. And what this poll showed, for example, is that 52% of British Muslims believe it should be illegal to show a picture of Muhammad. 34% believe that there should be Sharia law in this country. And perhaps most bizarrely of all, only one quarter of British Muslims actually believe that Hamas committed murder and rape in Israel on the 7th of October, which I think, you know, many people will find truly shocking, although they really shouldn't. Because you may remember back in the 1990s, when O.J. Simpson was charged with murdering his ex-wife and her friend, the vast majority of black Americans thought he was innocent. Now, to the rest of the world, that was a delusional point of view to have. But this is something that quite often happens with tribal loyalties in ethnic communities, is that despite the overwhelming preponderance of evidence to the contrary, they're disinclined to believe that if it puts in a bad light their own community. And that's precisely what we're having here to a great degree. And, you know, it just goes hand in hand with some other really bizarre viewpoints that UK Muslims have. Over the past decade, we've seen in polls, for example, 26% of UK Muslims don't believe that there's anything called Islamic extremism. 36% of British Muslims believe that Diana, Princess of Wales, was murdered because she was going to marry a Muslim. 31% of British Muslims believe that America was behind 9/11. 7% think the Jews were behind 9/11, compared with only 4% who actually think it was Al-Qaeda, which of course it was. And why is this? Well, it's because many of them lead lives which are completely segregated and have basically no interaction with wider British society. They consume entirely different media, things like Press TV from Iran and some very, very suspect channels on satellite, YouTube videos and Facebook videos on WhatsApp and so forth. So they are existing in an entirely different world. And it really just goes to show us that, you know, increased mass immigration means that it's going to be absolutely impossible to integrate such a large segment of society, because it actually is even worse than that. It goes beyond segregated communities now, because we know that educated Muslims hold a lot of these views. And lots of people on the left say, oh, within one or two generations, don't worry, they're going to become assimilated. Well, no, because actually Muslim youth are far more radicalized than their parents or grandparents. It's only going to get worse. One of the facts that I've mentioned before, one third of young British Muslims under 24 believe you should be put to death for apostasy, that's leaving the faith. And what's the response of our institutions, the police and government and so forth, is to deflect attention away from the Islamist mountain onto the far right molehill, and somehow trying to conflate the two and say, well, one is as bad as the other, if not the far right being far worse. They're petrified by political correctness, and no one in power or in any of the political parties is seemingly brave enough to tackle this very critical issue.
Well, also, just as I said at the beginning, it wasn't even covered that much. I mean, GB News did it, and it was in the Telegraph. I assume it had been given to the Telegraph. Whatever. You'd think, I mean, on the anti-Semitic point alone, apart from this crazy sort of lack of belief in what Hamas did, 46% supported Hamas. And then on top of that, there were all these kind of very old-fashioned tropes, you know, sort of Jews were too influential in finance, too influential in government, too influential in the media, you know, and in showbiz, all of these things.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, I think what's happening is we're almost getting two different versions of reality now, often in our society, where, you know, there'll be a lot of people who would disagree with this poll, and as you say, to just say, oh, it's from a conservative think tank. But I think the more broader issue is that even if we didn't have this poll, we've all seen this with our own eyes, with the hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of London. We've seen people carrying signs saying Hamas is a terrorist organisation being attacked. We've seen so much anti-Semitism on the streets of London. So, I mean, how much more evidence do you need? If the polling shows it, if the on-the-ground experience shows it, and people would still deny it, at that point you sort of think, well, people will just delude themselves and turn away from any kind of truth about this issue. And I think, as you say, another issue that you see in the media is that there's this idea of, if you're going to criticise one group, you need to criticise, or a religion, you need to criticise other groups. It needs to be equal. So you need to provide some kind of balance. Our media seems to all be about balance, but it's a very disingenuous kind of balance, because if one particular group has some sort of behaviour or some sort of ideas that the other groups don't, then how can you provide balance? You know, it's almost as though we have to criticise everyone if we're going to criticise this group. And we saw that with Rishi Sunak's speech, where he come out speaking out about Islamism and then spoke about the far right, which of course has not been an issue. That's not something any of us have been seeing on the streets of London or elsewhere. And you always see with these ideas of extremism also, the far left never comes up in this conversation. You know, we have Just Stop Oil, we have extreme elements of the trans lobby. That never gets talked about. And it's always this, well, Islamism, but the far right. So I just think it's become increasingly difficult for people to have a shared reality of this issue. And I think it's probably going to get worse, because we're going to be more and more unable to talk about.
Well, as you say, as you said, push it out. I think it's the younger they get, it was shown in this survey, something like 47%, I think, of young 18-25-year-olds, 40% of educated young Muslims also didn't think, you know, that Hamas had committed rape and pillage and murder on the 7th of October. But you see, when you're faced with that, I suppose that the media just simply doesn't quite know how to handle it. So how do they spin this? So they just don't report it.
And that's precisely what we've seen, because these facts are so shocking. Well, they're not shocking to those of us who obviously study this stuff, but they should be so shocking. This should be front page stuff. And even on the centre right media, you haven't had this coverage. GB News have been very good on this, and Talk TV, as you would expect. But beyond that, there's been a deafening silence. Whereas, of course, you know full well, if there had been, you know, 10% of these sort of poll findings for people on the right, this would have been front page coverage, and there'd be a Newsnight special on the whole thing. And of course, it's most worrying, because there's no pathway out of it, because the two things you would think that would come would lead to an improvement would be, of course, the young and the educated. And on both of those measures, there's no real difference in holding these completely bizarre views on in terms of the Hamas thing, but also completely abhorrent views in terms of their attitudes towards homosexuality, for example. Or, you know, I think 62% in another poll said that they wanted restrictions on free speech to avoid criticizing religion and so forth. And the most critical point is that it's only going to get worse, because these communities grow every single day thanks to mass immigration. And of course, the real problem is are segregated communities. People are twice as likely to be extremists if they live in segregated communities. But as this evidence shows, it's also amongst people in our country who are actually otherwise engaged in society, and that should worry us all very seriously.
Yes, I think it is, you know, I think it's been said before, but with multiculturalism, people said, oh, well, frankly, you know, you're going to have a certain amount of give and take, and you're going to have certain restrictions on free speech for it to work and all of that. But fact is that when you look at those sort of statistics about, you know, Mohammed and showing pictures of Mohammed, particularly after the Batley anniversary recently, which we talked about last week, I mean, this is an outright challenge, isn't it, to free speech?
Yeah, it's a major issue for free speech, and it will be going forward, I think, more and more. I think particularly with the laws around extremism. I mean, I think generally when we talk about extremism, we think of it as being a fringe, you know, that's generally how it's talked about. And with these issues, people always caveat, you know, the vast majority of Muslims don't feel this way, but there's this fringe extreme that do. And actually these polls show that it's roughly half of Muslims feel this way. Mm. So it's not a minority. Well, it's not a minority. So how then do we change our extremism laws or ideas around extremism to reflect that? Because it's almost as though people sort of have given up because the problem's so big. How would you manage? How would you enforce any kind of laws or policies around extremism when there's such a, it applies to such a large group of people?
Don't you think as well? I mean, I, you know, call me old school, but to me, the integrating should come from people coming. You know, it sort of is always portrayed as it's a failure. It's our failure. There's been a failure, as though somehow we have not paid enough attention to it. I mean, well, isn't the whole point of coming, you want to integrate, you should want to, or you should try to?
Well, it's our fault in terms of not selecting the right type of people who want to come here to integrate, you know. And I mentioned before, you know, Canada cherry picks the very best in society. You don't, until 10 years ago, you didn't have such big problems in North America because you tended to have more middle class Muslims coming to that country who were actually much happier to integrate. And we've chosen a very different type of policy in terms of immigration. And of course, it's always human nature to ghettoize. Mm-hmm. Whether you're English or you're from the Middle East, once you go somewhere, you tend to stick with your own kind. That's human nature. And if you're having mass immigration, where you have overnight sort of tens of thousands of people coming into the country, there's no incentive for them to integrate. And yeah. So the fault is on us for allowing such massive immigration, not having done, say, 20 years ago, what the Danes did, which was ensuring that no more than 30% of a community could be from an ethnic minority, ensuring that at schools no more than 30% of the school population could be of an ethnic minority, and so forth. Now Denmark has done all that within the last decade. I think it's too late now in this country to do that because the population are so high. And again, it's all about critical mass, right? Critical mass is about 15% of the population. This is something which we should all be aware about. And it's the cowardice of those in authority not to address this, to put their heads in the sand whilst the situation gets steadily worse and worse until it does reach critical mass. We're seeing it now on the streets with these anti-Israel marches. But the question is, where does it go from here? Because I think this has been a critical moment for people to realize that we're already at that critical mass stage. And you're going to have the rise of an Islamic party next, which means potentially political power, at least on the local level first, maybe then parliamentary power. These are really radically dangerous things for the body politic.
I think as well, of course, you say a rise of a Muslim party. You could say that there's a sort of nascent one within Labour. I mean, there's huge numbers of Muslim councils are actually Labour, but then they could sort of break away, couldn't they, and make some sort of, you know, association of their own. What strikes me as well during this period is that we've had all of these calls to prayer going on. This is presumably because of Eid Mubarak going on. But Buckingham Palace, we've had, in Canterbury Cathedral, and there was an extraordinary one. I saw a tape, you know, on Twitter, or X as it now is, of Cologne, a street in Cologne, everyone in dead silence listening to this call to prayer. And you sort of thought, whilst this all looks like, you know, it looks very much like goodwill and all of that, You just think, no, no, this is something else entirely.
No, it feels like a complete replacement, doesn't it? I think even over Easter, we were seeing that Easter eggs weren't being called Easter eggs, they were being called like greeting,
celebration
eggs. But there were Easter eggs appearing with Ramadan characters in the Easter eggs. And I mean, I went out on Sunday, on Easter Sunday, and I was seeing advertisements. I suddenly noticed bus stops with advertisements for Muslim charities that just had the word Allah written at the bus stop.
Really?
Yeah.
What was this?
This was in North London on Easter. And then I also walked past a kind of mural of children's pictures that were of celebrating Ramadan. And you are noticing it more and more. And we had that incident of the scripture of Islam being put up on the train display I think it was King's Cross. And you know, you do just think, hang on a minute, this is totally replacing Christianity at this point.
Well, you see, the people watching here now, I'm sure on their lips are saying, yes, we all agree with you, so what do we do? And I mean, the fact is, what do we do? What does this mean, actually? I mean, you know, when I was asked this, I did something on it on GB News, it's quite clearly that it's up to at least the government, senior politicians or whatever, to actually state unequivocally what kind of country we are, you know, and that there will be no, you know, compromise on certain issues. Mm. That is something that can be, you might say, well, that's just saying something. Actually, those things mean quite a lot, actually. You know, you've got to have leadership at least on this, on these issues of what are we and what will we not tolerate.
I think there's just a real naivety about this. There's two strands. There's the people who are just wanting to be tolerant, so kind of conservative MPs. You even see the Archbishop of Canterbury tweeting out about, you know, Ramadan blessing Muslims. But then what you see is with the Muslim groups, it's not about tolerance, it's about power. And it's kind of liberalism versus just attaining power. And those two things I think eventually the power-seeking group are going to take over.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what to do, but it's, we do need a political elite that will take this seriously, but I just don't think that they will.
Yeah. Well, that's just precisely the problem. I mean, you know, we know some of the things that can be done, but, you know, we've had a Conservative government for 13 or 14 years. The idea that the Labour Party is going to be doing anything on this is for the birds. If anything, things are going to get worse because the Labour Party are so scared of losing Labour Muslim voters because of Keir Starmer's stance on Israel that I think once they get to power, they will be doing everything they can to woo the Muslim vote back and stop an Islamic party. So I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. But what needs to be done is quite clear. Firstly, we need to be more like France. France is very clear. Now, France is a secular state. We have the established Church of England. But nevertheless, they are so strict about enforcing a ban on the burqa, for example, and on all sorts of issues where they stress the importance of being French first and foremost. As a result of that, in France, about 46% of French Muslims say that they're Muslim first and French second. Here, it's 81% of Muslims say that they're British first and they're Muslim first and British second. So we have a much bigger problem here than France, even though we always think of France as a place where they have more terrorist attacks. I think one reason is because, of course, Muslims over here think, well, we've got everything we want anyway. There's no need for us to actually rebel on this. Mm. Another thing is we should be deporting radicals from this country. Mm. And we should be deporting illegal immigrants, deporting radicals, and we should be closing down all of these Deobandi mosques that we have in this country. Something like half of the mosques in this nation are run by the Deobandi sect, which are the same group that started the Taliban in Afghanistan. Mm. And these are the places where you have the preaching of all this sort of hatred. Now, I'm all for free speech and everything else, but I think when it's actually causing the decay and destruction of social cohesion in this country, I think that it needs to be taken in hand.
Do you know that in Europe, something like 6,000 mosques are under construction?
Mm-hmm.
Under construction.
Yeah.
In Europe.
Well, churches are being closed.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, I mean, I'm not putting two and two together necessarily here, but or burning down. Strange thing, isn't it? Well, it's sort of been, you know, for people who did see it, it should be a bit of a wake-up call if you weren't already awake. Another one that's happened this week, actually, this very day, in fact, as we're recording on the Wednesday, is the publication of the CAS report. Now, we're talking generally about, aren't we, the whole trans situation here?
Yeah, so it was this primary issue of the Tavistock Gender Identity Service and the medication of young people who come with gender dysphoria. So we had the interim CAS review over a year ago. So we've sort of known what's coming. It's kind of nothing majorly new, but we have seen a few more things come out in this review today. I mean, Dr. Hirikas has been very clear that there was no evidence for puberty blockers. There was failings at every level within the NHS, within the government. The Tavistock Clinic refused to participate in an evaluation of a long-term study on these drugs. And Hirikas has made some recommendations actually that are quite interesting. She's suggested that going forward, these so-called new gender services that are being set up shouldn't even be called gender services. She just said it should be mental health, because pretty much all of the young people presenting with this kind of superficial feeling that they're not in the wrong body, they actually are often autistic, so they don't understand gender and sexuality very well, they have difficulty with their identity, or they're traumatized, and you can understand why a sexually abused girl would want to be a boy instead of being a girl, to avoid further assaults or abuse, or they have just depression or other mental health concerns, and that there was an over focus on this whole idea of gender that just there wasn't really an evidence base for it, and it was very ideological. And she also speaks about the idea of social transition, that young people's socially transitioning, there's no evidence that socially transitioning, i.e. changing your name, changing your pronouns, helps with this particular complaint. Actually, for most children, this issue desists. And actually, there can be real harms to socially transitioning, because if you tell everyone you're a different gender and you change your name and so forth, and then actually your feelings desist, it's quite hard to walk that back if you've been so open about it. And this also leads to the idea that, I mean, there are lots of young people who are changing their pronouns in their school and the school's going along with it, and they're not even receiving treatment for gender dysphoria. They're just announcing that they're a different sex or a different gender, and the school's going along with it. So it is an important day for this whole issue, and hopefully, I mean, everybody's celebrating, it remains to be seen whether the impact it will have, but it does. We are seeing, actually, what's interesting today, organisations like Stonewall and Mermaids and the Labour Party, who've been calling people transphobic for the last decade or so, actually falling in line with the CAS review.
Really?
Yeah, so Stonewall have said, they welcome these positive findings, even though Stonewall, I mean, one of the issues that was had within the Tavistock was that when they went to the Royal College of Psychiatrists to raise these issues, apparently it fell on deaf ears because they were trying to obtain a silver award from Stonewall. So these organisations have had a massive negative impact on the shutting down of speech within this area. And Stonewall have just been calling everybody transphobic for the last, J.K. Rowling and everyone, for the last 5 or 10 years. And Mermaids, which is a transgender charity, they were actually, quite significant in the Tavistock's decision to lower the age limit of puberty blockers. And now they're saying, it's great to have clear guidance from the CAS review. So many Labour MPs have gone banging on about everybody being transphobic. And now all the concerns that most of us had, which is laid out in this review, everybody's now suddenly sort of falling in line with it. And you just think, hang on, you were the ones pushing this and bullying everyone for years.
Mm. Everyone except India Willoughby is on side with this.
What's he saying?
She thinks the whole thing is a nonsense, and then she's poo-pooed the report in all sorts of ways, or he's poo-pooed the report, or what were they? But the key thing here, of course, is why did this take so long? This is a great review, and I learned a lot of stuff in it. But it took 4 years for this to come out. How many lives have been ruined over the course of those 4 years? Because the conclusions are the sort of things that Amy has been saying, what we've been saying for years. Mm-hmm. I have said for a long time, 21 should be the age at which people have any sort of medical or chemical intervention on these sorts of things. Even 18 is too young, I think, for someone to understand these sorts of things. We've talked about people going through phases, that's here as well, rather than actually putting people on a pathway. So it's a shame this took so long to come out. But yes, it is a great victory, and people should hang their heads with shame. Mm-hmm. The Yvette Coopers and others of this world who've come out today and said, things are very worrying. Well, I'm sorry, where were you when people like Graham Linehan and others were being dragged in the public square? But also some fascinating things here. So, you know, there were only 50 people who were transitioning who were children back in 2009. Now it's around 5,000. Mm. That's a 100-fold increase. And as Dr. Cass says in this report, you can't just explain this away as people now being more accepting of trans identities. It's because we once someone goes through this phase, now they're immediately put on this irreversible pathway towards transition. That didn't happen before. As Amy said, people with gender dysphoria are 6 times more likely to be autistic. And we need a far more holistic approach to this, because the mental health issues here seem to be so important in terms of why people may be questioning their sexuality. And rather than actually being truly desiring a sex change, they're just hugely confused and they may be self-harming in other ways. Mm-hmm. The most fascinating thing I thought was how the majority of people undergoing this now are women becoming men, whereas historically it was always men becoming women. Mm. And Dr. Cass suggests a lot of this is because of body issues, because of watching online pornography, watching social media, and suddenly hating your own body for what it is, and literally wanting to cut your breasts off and become a man, because seemingly when you're going through that troubled age of puberty and so forth, that seems to be the best way to have a sort of a more accepting life. I think all of these things are fascinating. And it's just such a shame that it's taken so long to get to this point.
Do you know, actually, that's right. I was looking through, for various other reasons, looking through some of these old shows that we do. On one of them, we were discussing a picture that Costa Coffee used a while ago. And it was just this happy little cartoon of a presumably a girl with her breasts cut, with these crosses to show that she'd had a double mastectomy. And you sort of think this is a form of insanity that we've gone through, but it's worse than that, because just saying insanity sort of almost to trivialize it. It's actually been a kind of barbaric thing, hasn't it? People have been cut up and mutilated.
Yeah, it's been totally, I mean, one of the recommendations that Dr. Hilary Cass makes is that there should be now a service to help detransitioners, because they have, those people that have gone through it and have regretted it and have been totally let down, there's been no service to help them. And as you say, when there's images celebrating, scarring and surgery, which they've now since regretted, it's been so hard for that particular group. Mm. I think it's,
Yes, wait a minute, that's a very important point, by the way, earlier, when you said that, is it one of the recommendations of the council report that this should now be called mental health?
Yeah.
Well, that's almost like a complete triumph, isn't it?
It's obvious.
I mean, over ideology.
Yeah, it's obvious. I mean, this whole thing as trans, it's been presented, I think, as though it's similar to just being gay or even just any kind of identity, like being black. And if you're just trans, that's it, and people should just accept that, and it's a total aside to your mental health concerns. But of course, it's completely the opposite. You're feeling a discomfort in your body. You're experiencing almost a delusion that you should have been born in the wrong body. Of course, that's mental health. Of course, it's not the same as being gay or having any kind of marginalised identity. So the whole language around trans has meant that we've never really been known where to place it. It's been placed in identity. It's been placed in sexuality. Even the whole LGBT doesn't make sense, because it's not a sexuality. It's a desire to want to be in a different body, which cannot be fulfilled. You can't change sex. Yeah. So it's a problem. It's very different from being gay. So I think, I think that's the issue. And I think people are waking up to that now. And hopefully the language will change, because you are still seeing, there was 2 recent cases of 2 young girls who committed suicide in the papers this week. One was autistic and one had a history of sexual abuse. And it's both, they were trans, and the media referring to them as he. And you just think this is a sick response from a society to girls committing suicide to just call them he. Mm. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, once this has sunk in, and also trickled down, because it takes forever, it's like multiculturalism. People talk about it here on this sort of level maybe, and then it takes a while for it to go down to local councils and all this sort of thing. Why this happened, I think that's the next most important thing, I think. Why this issue, and why did it become so pervasive, I think is it's because it's an attack, basically, on our very sense of ourselves. That's my view, or on the basis of our kind of society.
Yeah, I just think it's... Yeah, I think there's just a sickness, isn't there? I think around these ideas of identity and and relationships and probably social media. I think there's all sorts of things in the mix. But of course ideology as well, you know.
Yeah, and I've never had a problem with adults changing their sex, you know. I've always, as long as they don't have access to female-only spaces, I'm personally perfectly happy with that. If they want to pay for it themselves and so forth, but it's just been the exponential growth that we've seen, you know. So, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you know, I had a huge compassion for people going through all of this. But to think that from that point, we've got to so many thousands of people now going through what before only a handful would do, suggests that something broader is going on in society. And one of the issues, of course, is that we only now say trans. We don't say transsexuals. So transsexuals are the people that I think of when I think about trans. But I think it was quite deliberate. And those are the people for whom I have sympathy if they're going through issues in life. But it's the fact that we now refer to trans, which includes transvestites, so somebody who wants to dress up as a woman for whatever reason. You may remember the Bounty commercial, you know, with the kitchen roll sort of a thing. You know, that's just a fetish. That's not really any sort of great sexual. But everything is now included underneath this umbrella term of trans. And I think a lot of the problems stem from that.
Well, actually, it's interesting because transvestite in the old sense, you know, did not mean necessarily that your sexuality was different. You know, I mean, you know, it was like husbands. Oh, I've discovered my husband. Nice dressing up in my clothes.
Most transvestites were straight men. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's kind of like straight as they come, etc. He couldn't be as that straight, but anyway. But yes, it's a kind of kink or whatever. The crucial thing as well is that, of course, they no longer bother to have, you know, gender reassignment in terms of actually the operation, as we used to call it.
That's what that's where the issue is. I think it's that point. If you're willing to go through the entire procedure, right, the Jan Morrises of this world, the former historian that was James Morris, who seemed perfectly happy having gone through that process, then I can see there's a clear case there. But if you're not willing to have the surgery, if you're just, you know, a bloke in a wig, then I'm sorry, but you know, there's something else going on here. This is not true. The true transsexual we think of when we think of trans, this is the transvestite. This is the transvestite, or another side to the issue. And I think just calling it trans misleads so many people about what a great portion of this population is actually about.
Yes, it's the very basis of this, because it has gone through so many different layers now, hasn't it? Would you say, therefore, would you agree that? Or disagree on two things. First of all, that someone can be born in the wrong body. I mean, that was one of the tropes. And the other one is that can a woman or a man change sex?
No, to either of them.
No, well, I've said for a long, long time on this channel and others that we know from brain scans that the homosexual brain and the heterosexual brain are different with the hypothalamus and so forth. You also know that the brain of a psychopath, you can tell, is different as well. So you can identify those. I'm just waiting to see what the brain of a transsexual looks like, because if someone is born with this abnormality or with this different brain, then you can actually say, well, there's a reason this person thinks that way. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're in the wrong body, but there is a reason. Well, paedophiles also, paedophiles, psychopaths as well, homosexuals, there's all things in the brain you can clearly see today. And I've never seen any evidence about whether that also applies to transsexuals, and that's what I'm waiting for before I can give any sort of opinion on whether it's nature, nurture, or something else.
Don't you think that the whole thing really is, well, it's just the element of compulsion, that basically we were being compelled to go along with something and, you know, risk being utterly kind of, you know, sort of stigmatized if you didn't. As you say, transfer, very vicious, could be very, very vicious as well. You know, I think of April Ashley, who was one of the famous first people, 1960s, used to be in the Navy, had the operation, as people used to call it there. I mean, you know, to all intents and purposes, a very tall, very elegant woman, but it was obviously actually a man, very deep voice, big hands, all of these things.
But, yeah, we've forgotten so much about what this kind of surgery was about. It was about managing, you know, a mental health issue. That if you felt so uncomfortable in your body and therapy or drugs or medication didn't work, and the only way was to try to change your body, despite, you know, obviously all the potential side effects of surgery and all the risks, that, that if that's the only way you could live, then that, that is the absolute last option. Whereas now it's just kind of fast tracked onto it. There's no attempt to try and live with your faults or your feelings. And this umbrella term of trans, I've seen it in the NHS so much, where someone will just say, oh, this person's trans. You know, it's, as I said, it's like just saying, oh, they're gay. And it's like, well, hang on, I have questions about that. Well, I don't know what trans, there's a shared understanding of what gay means, but none of us know what trans means. Yeah. It could mean all sorts of things. So am I allowed, you know, and there's just this deafly silence. Oh, okay, they're trans. And everybody's got sort of, you know, everybody's sort of thinking, what exactly does that mean? But nobody will ask.
I always just thought it was transsexual. You know, that I, but it's absolutely not.
No.
Oh, well, I mean, it's a good thing, therefore, we've had this report. You know, I'm not going to try and be complacent or whatever. We should obviously end on a bad note, otherwise we're going to be letting ourselves down. There's been some shenanigans going on at the Foreign Office, hasn't there?
Yes, I mean, this is a ridiculous report from ex-Foreign Office mandarins, diplomats, are very senior as well.
You can't call them that anymore, mandarins.
Tatsumas, I don't know. It's basically pointing out all of the problems in the Foreign Office and linking so much of it back to our history, and essentially saying that we need to get rid of the colonial paintings from the Foreign Office and perhaps even leave Sir George Gilbert Scott's glorious building because it's too imperial. Now, it's one of the world's most beautiful government buildings. I can't imagine the French saying the same thing about their headquarters on the Quai d'Orsay. But, you know, the idea they want us to move into the future by abandoning our past. And I could just think, you know, the Russians and the Chinese must be absolutely laughing at us. You know, they're masters of international diplomacy. And, you know, proud, self-confident nations aren't constantly fretting about their past and self-flagellating. And you're not going to change the Foreign Office by just doing some interior decorating, you know. The fact is that what these mandarins don't actually understand is that the problem isn't the past, the problem is them. They are the problem. We have, for the last three decades, allowed our institutions to be run by people who have an absolute loathing for Britain and in a complete embarrassment about anything to do with national pride or with natural patriotism. These are, as I said before, these are cuckoos in the nest. And quite frankly, they are the source of so much of the decline of Britain and the decline of British pride. For example, they say that Britain should stop trying to appear great on the world stage. It should accept that it's a middling power like Canada. Well, I'm sorry, we are much larger than Canada. We're much richer than Canada, you know, at GDP level. And we've got a much larger population and a much larger military still to this day. And I think now, of all times, we should actually be standing as tall as we can in an uncertain world. And you don't increase your soft power status by denigrating your glorious history and by abandoning those things that actually people around the world love, like our glorious buildings.
Yeah, well, I think it would probably end up as a hotel if they did move out, wouldn't it? And I'm not being frivolous there, because if you go along Whitehall, there's that beautiful building, I can't remember what it used to be.
The Old War Office.
Old War Office, it's now Raffles, right? It's been done up in what I would describe as this kind of modern, generic luxury. You know, it's a kind of generic luxury, international banal, I could call it, right?
Yeah.
But the Foreign Office, as you say, is quite stunning, isn't it? It's been stood in for God knows how many things as well, in movies and everything, so very beautiful. You could see that's what. And they'd be quite happy with that, wouldn't they?
Well, the thing is, the Foreign Office has always hated Britain, much longer than Tony Blair coming to power. I don't know if you remember, in the 80s, there was an episode of Yes, Prime Minister, where Jim Hacker, the Prime Minister, says, the White House believes the Foreign Office is full of communists and traitors. And his secretary, Woolley, says, it's not entirely full of them. It's always been that way. They've always had a loathing. In particular, they hate these wonderful murals painted in the 1920s. By Sigismund Goetze, who was actually a Jewish Huguenot, two oppressed minorities who came to Britain as refugees, because these paintings celebrate the rise of Britain from the Anglo-Saxon era through to becoming the center of mother of parliaments, and then spreading that parliamentary democracy to Canada and Australia and elsewhere, up to the founding of the League of Nations. Now, that is something which should inspire us all, that this small island was able to do so much for international diplomacy, world institutions, and for parliaments around the world.
The problem is, though, I don't know, did you see that terrible effort by the Tory party. It was a poster, why we are the second most powerful country. They withdrew it. They took it in because it was so terrible. It was pants. And it was a picture of Rishi Sunak in the middle. They used a picture of the king. Did you see this?
No, I didn't see
it. It was like, it was derided, but I have to say, probably correctly derided. I mean, it had an old English football team. It had a kind of an airplane, which in fact is actually more American than British. And it was sort of don't let the naysayers and doomsters win.
Yeah, it looked like, it's sort of half between a sort of a terrible movie poster and like some kind of collage,
yes.
You know, and it was just
badly
so
done.
And it didn't inspire greatness. It was about, you know, and the Foreign Office, places like the Foreign Office do, because they are really beautiful and very grand. And when you're in somewhere that's grand and great, you have great faults. You think, you know, you think differently, you act differently. And modernity doesn't
Good
seem
point.
To, you know, incorporate that.
No.
Modernity just thinks it doesn't matter. Your surroundings don't matter. Beauty doesn't matter. You know, your history doesn't matter. You know, if you're seeing all these great statesmen, you feel, you know, obliged to, well, I better aim to
up
be
my game.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Whereas if you're in just some dingy kind of grey looking modern, you know, place, you're not gonna it's not gonna inspire people to be bold or to be great leaders.
I think that's a very good point, because just in the last week or so, we've also had the story about the Nike English flag on the back of the English sports team, and then another one with the Olympic Team GB flag being all sorts of multicoloured nonsense. Now this thing about leaving the Foreign Office. I think this all tells you that this is about no one understanding the value of national symbols and so forth. When the Iron Curtain collapsed, the first thing that the countries of Central and Eastern Europe did was restore their national symbols, their flags and their coats of arms. And now that they've got the money in Hungary and Poland, they are rebuilding and restoring all of their great buildings and putting back their government departments, because that's how a nation takes pride, is from these sorts of things, not actually, by abandoning them.
Actually in Hungary, of course, because we covered it, didn't we, in Hungary, actually rebuilding, you know, brick by brick, these stunning, in the castle district in Budapest, beautiful. And also their parliament building was inspired by our parliament building. It's very interesting, if you look at it in Budapest, it's sparklingly beautiful, and ours is kind of virtually in mothballs.
I'd say theirs is even more beautiful than ours, which is a tough thing, because we think of ours being the most beautiful in the world. But but of course we are the nation that invented the modern world, and the fact that, you know, the Hungarian parliament was based on ours just goes to show the influence that this little island had. And I didn't see the poster with Rishi Sunak, but the fact remains that we are the number two soft power in the world, just in terms of like the music, how much music we've produced. Only America's done more in terms of music, in terms of movies and television, popular culture, the monarchy and sort of sport and everything else. No nation comes close to matching us apart from America. And the very things that people around the world love seem to be the things that we want to tear down.
Yes, also in fact, a disproportionately large diplomatic system still in existence, which is a hangover maybe from empire. I think the fact really is that with this terrible, terrible poster, you know, or meme actually, or whatever, it showed you that people who should know better have lost their what would you call it?
Marbles.
No, sorry. Not their marble. They've lost their knack.
Yes, yeah.
They don't even know basically how to do it. And it therefore it just comes across as completely insincere
and childish and unserious.
And we're losing our marbles into the bargain. Yeah. Literally, they're going back to Greece, aren't they? So, anyway, look, thank you very, very much, Shane. Thanks for helping me out there. Thank you very much. And we shall see you next time. Don't forget about the events in Carlisle and Beaconsfield on Wednesday. See you then. Bye. Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support.
From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.